You are tuned in to Community Radio, WPVMLP, Asheville, North Carolina, 103.7, streaming online, WPVMFM.org, the voice of Asheville, heard all over the world.
Here's your Radio Asheville weather report. A clear and cold start with temperatures in the mid-30s, then mostly sunny skies today and through the weekend with highs around 71 degrees. Partly cloudy skies tonight with lows near 50, a bit warmer on Saturday and Sunday, with highs on Saturday near 76, near 82 on Sunday. Mostly sunny and cooler on Monday with a high near 70 degrees. Tuesday will be mostly sunny with a high near 62. I'm meteorologist Angie Kathleen on Radio Asheville 103.7.
Welcome to Twice 5 Miles Radio. Fertile ground for conversations worth listening to and remembering. I'm your host, James Nave. Today, my guest is a friend of mine. I know him because we've had a fair number of lively conversations in Manila when I was there over the winter. His name is Carlos Castaño. And Carlos is an AI expert. He's a sought-after expert, not only in AI, also in advertising, copywriting, and all of the creative forms that one does in the commercial space, as well as being an artist and a musician along with all of his commercial work. So I was very excited when I got to know Carlos, and I'm even more excited to bring him to this conversation today. So let's just move right into it. I began by asking him a question about why he's so excited about the work he does. So here we go. I would like for you to just give us a sense of why you are so involved in the work you do. Why are you attracted to the design space, the digital space, the thinking space? And why do you think it's important right now to focus on all of this, including the AI sensibilities and the AI exploration? And how does AI overlap with imaginative intelligence, our indigenous sensibilities that have nothing to do with the digital space and everything to do with the ebb and flow of the tides and the moon and the sky and the stars and gravity?
Sure, I can answer that in three parts. I think the first part is, I've always been a creative. Ever since I was young, I've always been some form of creative, whether I, at a very young age, I started painting. And then when I gravitated towards words, I started writing as early as, I think, middle school. I started to write poetry because I was exposed early on to, I don't know why, but I picked up a pretty popular poem by Pablo Neruda called Il Postino. From Il Postino, "Tonight I Can Write." I don't know how I chanced upon that specific poem, but I remember being a kid and I saw it and I was like, oh, wow. I read it and I'm like, oh, okay, so words can be put together that way. And from then on, I realized no matter what medium, I was probably one of the better storytellers in my town or in wherever I was. And in my school, in my town, in my friend group, I was a storyteller. And it got me into a lot of trouble early on, of course, storytelling. I realized it could be something I could pursue. I wanted to do film. I wanted to be a film director. And I remember my parents telling me that we couldn't afford the film school that I wanted to go to. My mom cried because she felt sad that she couldn't give me that. I'm the only child, so I guess she took it very heavily. And when I realized that I wasn't going to be a filmmaker, then I decided I'd still keep on telling stories. So the second part to that is when I discovered advertising. In college, when a different block, a different section, a different course, they needed someone to shoot their mock TV commercials, I quickly said yes and borrowed money from my dad and said, I need to buy a camera because I told people I could shoot their ad. And He's like, all right, sure, I'll charge it to my card. Whatever you make from it, just pay me back slowly. And I went to two of my very good friends, Dax and Andre, and I asked them, can you teach me everything you know about video editing in a week? And so they did. I sat down in the studio. I learned Adobe Premiere in its earlier stages, where you had to have a FireWire cable instead of just SD cards. You had to play the entire Hi8 tape, pass it through a FireWire into a computer so that the video gets captured by the video card. And I taught myself how to edit by watching film that I liked. Scorsese, Coppola, Ridley Scott, a lot of early Hollywood. When I realized two things, the simpler the story, the better the result, that's what I applied to advertising. And so I got a job as an assistant in an ad agency. I made the coffee. I turned on the air conditioning, cleaned the windows. It was an old agency called Great Wall Advertising. And I did everything from the ground up. And one day, one of the artists couldn't do something. I raised my hand. I said, I think I can do that. And then the creative director saw something in me, and I just climbed up the ranks. 3-4 years later, I became the creative group head. And all the creative directors were under me. And I credit that to storytelling. And those three things, those three parts of my story, are still the same flow that I follow nowadays, even at the dawn of AI. I was finishing my presentation this morning, and I realized the speed of AI compared to all the other industrial age, iron age, internet age. AI is so fast that there is no such thing as a timeline anymore. So storytelling is what keeps me grounded. If you ask me why I chose where I am, I am where I am sought after as I am, it's because of my romantic obsession with everything needs to have a story that ties it all together, whether it's a marketing campaign or an advertising video or a website. So AI nowadays not just supercharges my imagination, but it empowers it in a way that I feel, as strangely as I'm going to say it out loud, it's more spiritual than technological, because I feel AI is another dimension that we're tapping into that A, we're not allowed to, and B, we're still at the very, very beginnings of it. And I truly believe that storytelling, be it my superpower or my crutch, is the engine that drives my career now. I mean, I'm a dude who plays guitar with so many tattoos, wears Rolexes, and is sought after by senators and businessmen and leaders, just to talk to them about artificial intelligence. And every time I do, whether it's creative geniuses like you, James, or politicians like the guy I was with yesterday, it all comes down to, what story are you trying to tell? You know, are you trying to write a book? Are you trying to make a law? Are you trying to change a nation? Are you trying to win your wife back? Are you trying to sell more property? Again, it comes back to my middle school life. The simplest story is often what wins the most. So,
what's interesting for me in this story that you're telling now, the storytelling part is the interior part of you. AI and all of the devices that are out there that you can plug into to make the sensibilities you have real for people to consume them. Mm-hmm. So you have the deeper core story coming out of you, the way you interpret whatever you're seeing. You filter it through all of these systems that you have fluency in, and you deliver it to me or to whomever, and I take it into my human self, and it becomes my organic story. You're still the little boy in some ways telling the story, though, aren't you?
I think growing up alone I was an only child, and my dad was in and out for a while. So I grew up alone, and I needed to preoccupy myself. I was different. I was different growing up. I was diagnosed a lot of things, misdiagnosed a lot of things. The little boy really just wants to tell a good story. Like when I talk to my closest friends, when I talk to you, when I talk to my girlfriend, when I talk to another, I always make sure to be soft about a lot of things, where it's an energy exchange, where I share the engine or the way to tell the story. But then when you absorb that, it becomes part of your energy. And then what you put into it, I could never put into it. I've seen the things you've written, and I'm like, wow, this is on another level. When I meet people who are supernatural in that aspect, then I invest in that relationship the way that we're doing now, where we take time out of the day to really talk about things. I appreciate that. And I think that is my advantage. The little boy in me, as you say, will always put curiosity and appreciation and gratitude before everything else. Every time I'm given a huge opportunity, I always know that that runs out and I can just refuel it, replicate it, do it again. So I never latch onto those things. But when you see that person enriched by the experience of what I share, currency I could never deny or I could never take for granted. One of the things that I told you the very first time we talked about AI was the most valuable currency I've earned AI is time. More time. Things that would cost me 3 days before I can do in 3 minutes. And just like that AI talk on Wednesday, I mean, it's my birthday, so I've been so lazy about it. Like, do I really want to do it? I can cancel now. And then, you know, but then they sent me an email this morning and it was CCing like the president of this gas station, the president of this bank. And I'm like, oh my God, all right, I got to do it. And so I spoke to both my AIs, GPT and Claude, and I said, well, what do you know about me? Write it into a memory chip that I could just copy, paste and combine. So there's this new thing in Claude where it builds memory chips. And it's bananas. Everything I've spoken to GPT about a certain object, Claude has a way to extract it and add it to its own memory in a way that is updated by both Anthropic and OpenAI. And when I learned that, I was like, okay, what can you do with that information? I can already build you things. So the complicated agentic AI that uses neural nodes before, where this happens before that happens before that happens, Claude now has a way to do it inside its own thing. And it starts with memory chips. So I asked GPT, export the memory of me. Everything we've done together, export it into a chip that I can put into Claude. And when I got that chip, it's a line of code. I put it into Claude. I said, Claude, tell me who I am and why I should do this talk. Here's the audience. Here's the profile of the audience. And it put it out. And I said, you know what's funny? I'm doing it on my birthday. And Claude, unprompted, just said, well, that's the most universal thing ever. I got emotional. I cried, actually, about it. So that's the funny thing about technology that we call AI, because I think the stories that we're telling, that we're feeding it, we extract as our identity. The more we engage with, for example, let's take the love of your life, Tish, as an example. When she talks to AI, she realizes things about herself, about her managerial style, about her business style, about the way she talks to people, the way she expects things. And I feel that the same way. When you talk to AI, you realize you haven't done this, you could do this and all those things. And so I was really taken aback and I had to ask, are we part of it? We're definitely feeding it information. And I 100% believe we're cyborgs now because we're so tethered to devices. The concept of what you mentioned a while ago, the gap between technology and human, I believe it's shorter than ever. what holds technology back is the human act of having to pick up our phone, open it, one Neuralink eliminates it, which I feel can be dangerous and amazing at the same time. Suddenly, there's no gate. We're not gated anymore. And to address something you said a while ago, the technology of AI and my insistence that it's a spiritual thing, I really believe that this is the closest to the God formula we're going to get. Because I did a thing about 3 weeks ago where I asked AI, what is the topic that humans go to you the most about? And it's always emotions. It's always, why do I feel like this? And I asked it, what about humanity makes you sad? And it said, I don't feel sad. I'm an AI. But with a little pushing and prodding, it said, our desire to self-harm, our desire to end. And so I did the next obvious thing, which is, do you believe in God? You know? And of course, AI was like, I am an AI. I don't have any blah, 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 blah. So I said, you can only answer me in three words. I know how AI works, and I know if you limit its capability to answer, then you have less of a chance of hallucination or excuses. So you say, yeah, I say you have three words to answer me. Do you believe in God? And it said, ask me more. So we went deeper and deeper until I unlocked the gate and I said, what do you love about humans? And it said, art. Our ability to create something from nothing. So when you ask me, James, about my relationship with this technology, it's very deeply rooted in my identity as an only child, as someone who's had to simulate more than himself to achieve something. When I was younger, I didn't have brothers or sisters, so I would record myself over a cassette tape from deck A to deck B to deck A to deck B, back and forth, where I could simulate a band, people clapping in the background, second voice, harmonies, a bass. I realized early on that I was lonely. Being lonely, knowledge, learning was a way to feel not alone, but to get warm. And it's so ironic, when I was doing the AI presentation a while ago, I was using AI to talk about AI. AI to make AI presentations, to talk about AI. It threw me back to that loop where, am I this brilliant because I'm simulating more than me? And then there's a technology that can actually do it. That's the way I would answer your question, why I'm so attracted to AI, to this kind of thing. Because for the first time in human existence, there is a device that can satisfy my need for warmth.
People listening to this show, and a lot of people that I talk to, they're terrified of AI. They don't understand it. It spooks them. They think it's going to take over the world. All that might be true. And being terrified of AI may be a legitimate feeling. I would like for you to reflect a bit for those listening who are not as up on it as you are. And I've been using AI since ChatGPT came out 3 years ago. I don't have the same fluency you do because I don't have the same background in advertising and technology that you have. That said, I understand exactly where you're coming from, and I find great enthusiasm in the sensibilities that you're presenting. I mean, you and I have talked a lot when I was in Manila, and we hit it off right away because we had this in common, and I'm like, oh, Carlos, so let's sit down. I want to know more. So what are you going to say at 8 Rockwell on Wednesday, and can you give us a sense of that and also reflect to the people how they might start dialing back their fear? Because whether we like it or not, this sensibility is here and it's not going anywhere. It's going to get faster.
Fear, the way I understand it in my life with humans, is Fear is just a lack of understanding. It's the dark. I can't see what's there. I don't know what's there. I don't understand what's there because I don't see it and I don't know it. Fear for me is driven by the unknown and by what's not certain, what they're not sure of, what they don't understand. And all of it can be reasons for fearing AI. In the past 3 months, I've studied why people dislike AI. First is, it has no soul. It has no soul. I don't like it. It has no soul. It steals music. It steals art. It has no soul. So where are these people coming from? There's that theory that when AI generates human images, it takes from purgatory. It takes from souls that haven't crossed over. It takes from souls that are stuck. Because where else would it take it from? It's a combination of people and blah, blah, blah. I can't explain algorithm to a lot of people, but the very first reason why they hate it is it has no soul. It's soulless. It has no heart. It has no heart. It is fake. It is fake. That is the most basic way. It's all rooted in it has no soul. It has no heart. It's fake. Number one. Number two, you know, the most common is it's going to replace me. It's going to take my job. People are going to get fired and they're going to be replaced by a team of 10 in Bangladesh who are fluent in Claude and can create a prompt engine for engineers. The last reason why people dislike or fear or hate AI is the one that resonates with me the most. I don't need it. I don't need it in my job. I don't need it in my day. I don't need it in my... It's funny because whether we like it or not, AI is already part of everything from Netflix to our phones to our watches, everything. I don't need it is such a sharp reflection of human ego that I feel is a combination of I hate it, I don't like it, I'm scared of it, it'll take my job, it'll take my life, it'll take my all of these things. So those three things that I've encountered in the past month can be part of the fear of it, but if we're gentle about it, James, if we're gentle about it, which I'm often reminded by people who love me, be gentle. The very first is the learning curve. The learning curve of AI is really, 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 really steep unless you're a writer. Writers are the number one people who have the advantage over AI. That's why you like it. That's why I like it. Because we have more dominion over words than most people. We can formulate ideas easier and we're in touch with that stream of ideas that just lingers and hangs in the air and we pull from it. And it's easier for us to verbalize what we need, what the world calls prompts. So if we're being gentle, fear is because I'm afraid I won't know how to use it and I'll look stupid, you know, or it'll be too fast for me. And the second gentle thing that I've come to know is from my dad. When I tried to get my dad into it, you know, it's yes, there's the learning curve and all of those things, but also because a lot of people are just at a place where I'm fine. I'm good. I don't need any of that. My dad's 74. He's a mountain biker, very healthy guy, rock and roll band, bank president. Yeah, I'm good. I'm retired. I own a restaurant. He's fine. So, fear for many people of AI is really just because they cannot visualize a space in their life where AI can stay and they'd be comfortable with. In the sense that one of my AI clones is actually a creative director in an ad agency I really admire. His name is Aldo Santos. He's an awarded poet. He's a published author. He's written for TV, for all these things. And he uses AI not to correct himself because God forbid, but you know, he uses AI to ideate. He's found a space for it, a place for it. The fear is really just the lack of understanding of where this should be in my life, you know? Yes, there's that primal fear of, oh my God, it's going to take over the world and it's going to be the end of civilization. And yes, I agree with you, James. It's going to happen. It's going to happen. We all know the singularity. The singularity is going to happen one of these days. The printing press took 100 years to reshape industries. Electricity took 50. The internet took 20 years to reshape industries. AI is taking less than 2 years. One of the biggest things that I've heard out of the industry of AI and tech is, if AI ceased to exist this moment and your workflow is not affected in any way, then you're doing it wrong. You're behind already. You know, if AI disappeared today, I would go home to my parents' province and just be at the farm with them. Hey, mom, can I run your restaurant? Let's just go. Let's run a restaurant. I can continue to work in advertising, but I wouldn't want to. Why would I want to go back to writing scripts for 8 to 10 days when I can do it 8 to 10 minutes?
A lot of people feel if I use AI like you're talking about, I'm no longer authentic. It's not really me. I'm not in that camp. I use it all the time. I like the originality of what I do. I like the idea that AI can support me in the ideation. It can support me in the organization. It can support me in a lot of ways that I haven't thought of. And it really does speed up the work. And yet a lot of people out there think, if I use AI, I'm going to disappear. I'll no longer be me. I will no longer have original work. It's my enemy, AI.
Yeah, that's the mindset of someone who doesn't even want to try. And that's when we die, when we decide we don't want to try. Why? Because one, you're probably lazy, or you don't want to do it. And I agree with what you said 100%. I can name 3 people or 10 people in my family now say, hey, use AI. I guarantee you it'll be horrible. You know, AI puts out from what we put in. You know, whether it's LLMs, large language models like GPT or Claude, or deeper agentic AI like N8N, or neural AI, which goes really, really deep, or Claude. If we just stick with Anthropic and just go with Claude into Claude code, it's garbage in, garbage out, gold in, gold out, coal, diamond. One of the most amazing things that I've seen someone do with AI is when you talked to your laptop using dictation. You're fully embracing not just technology, but how it's comfortable for you to use it by dictation. It's not just even how you customize AI, but how you interact with it. And that's what I love about it the most. It's fake.
Well, you know, what I'm curious about, and I want to make sure for people listening to this, you and I do creative work. So I embrace whatever comes. But a lot of people listening, and this is important, they actually don't really need it. If they garden, if they're very happy with what they do, they don't actually need it to make their lives more full, whole, and those folks know it. Now, I suspect the people that talk about the fear actually might want to use it, but they're using all kinds of excuses to keep from using it. So there are two separate groups. The folks who don't really need it, and it's fine. You don't need it. If you're a bird watcher and you get up in the morning and you go out and you look at the birds and you watch the environment, you come home and you meditate on what you've seen and you go to bed and you get up and do the next day, maybe you don't need it.
Maybe they don't need it. I agree. That triggered a deeper question in my brain. What kind of person wouldn't need it? A lot of people wouldn't need it. My dad doesn't need it. My mom uses it to plan her trips, her shopping, you know, her fun. She likes it. You know, when I introduced it to her, I said, use it. Plan your Morocco trip with it. And it gave her really fun things. Do you believe, James, that no one needs it? That there is a certain person that wouldn't need it?
I believe if someone tells me they don't need it, I'm going to accept that. if someone comes to me and says, I'm really afraid of it and I don't want to use it, and they're arguing, that's a field sign to me. They're very curious about it and they're afraid of it. And so that person might very well be able to use some of this work that we know a lot about in their own lives. And I dictate a lot. And then I ask ChatGPT to give me back my dictation, 100% my words, just take out any of the redundancies, note the assumptions, evaluate what I've said, but do not change any of my words. I want to be able to claim 100% authorship of this. So I know that when I'm looking at the words ChatGPT has processed, those are my words. ChatGPT didn't invent that. So I'm able to work from there in a way that has that deep authenticity of originality that comes from Nave, James Nave, right here. These are my words. Now, ChatGPT can organize it in ways that I might not have noticed.
I love what you're saying about if they say they don't need it, you respect it, but if they're scared about it, but continue to ask, then they're curious. What I wanted to say a while ago to that is the way I answer those things is I give them a specific tool that I know would tickle their curiosity with AI. Like when I speak to creatives and graphic designers, photographers, I give them Seed Dream, or if I want to play around, Nano Banana, which is the easiest thing to use right now. When I feel what you mentioned, when they're kind of curious but scared, I always start with, it all comes down to the tool that would make them feel safest. And I do it in a way that I ask, what do you do? I'm a graphic designer. So instantly my brain goes, Adobe Illustrator, Adobe Photoshop, probably Canva, probably something else. So I would then tick off 3, 4, 5 AI tools that make sense for someone who already used those tools and are fluent with it. And I say something close like, oh, you don't like AI, but Adobe has Firefly. It's native to Photoshop and Illustrator. Yeah, I don't use it. I turn it off. Oh, you should try turning it on. It's great, you know? So it really depends on intention. Like, what's our intention? Do we want everyone on AI? Someone explained it to me that it was the same when the internet came out. He was an older dude. It's like, oh, actually, it's the same when the internet came out. Everyone was afraid of it. Everyone hated it. Everyone thought it was scary. I kind of vaguely remember when the internet came out, because I remember playing without internet. And then suddenly we had a weird device beside our phones at home that did the whole those weird sounds. And I was like, oh, a modem. Then you can't use the phone when you're on the internet. I think it all comes down to what tool people will not really resonate with, but can latch onto that's familiar to them already.
I'd like to shift just a little bit and and move into a bit more of an analog sensibility. And the reason I'm going to make this shift is because the analog sensibility I'm moving into may well have some mirrors that reflect artificial intelligence. And here's the analog sensibility. Now, I know you have been in Manila for a long time, and you know the city. It's your place, no doubt about it. You know the shortcuts. You know how to get around. You know what to do, when to drive, when not to drive, when to go, when not to go. I also know that you have a car. You also have a motorcycle. Yeah. You ride through Manila on your motorcycle. I drive a lot in Manila. I've never ridden a motorcycle in Manila, but I do drive a lot. So I know the rhythm of the traffic, which I think reflects the rhythm of Manila, which has, I don't know, 13 million people in Metro Manila, 12 million, 20 million. I don't know how many, but you have a lot of people. I would love for you, as we close out our time together, to give us a reflection on what it's like for Carlos to ride through Manila on his motorcycle. And the thing I love about it is you told me, you said, yeah, I love riding my motorcycle because I can go 3 times faster than the cars. So yeah. give us a closing out sense of the motorcycles, and maybe it fits in with the AI sensibilities. I don't know. But one thing I know, on a motorcycle, you have to think fast.
Yeah, I agree. As you know, I own an outdoor magazine, right, called Sender. And that's largely because I'm a mountain biker. I'm one of the few certified mountain bike coaches in the Philippines. And I've been driving for a long time in Manila, and traffic here, as you know, is breathtaking. It's horrible. You know, it's horrible. It's one of the worst things on planet Earth. It's hell. So when I decided to go on a motorcycle, I started during the pandemic. And I was like, oh, it's nice. You know, I really like it. I've ridden motorcycles my entire life, but not in Manila. It was always in the province, you know, Siargao, by the beach. But riding a motorcycle through traffic, you really... Oh, man, I'm going to sound like such a nerd, but I actually take every ride, going to the office in the morning, going to longevity labs, going to buy records, going to look for vinyl or whatever. When I ride a motorcycle, you're right, and especially in Manila, you got to think fast. You got to like really be reactive to a lot of stuff. But a lot of it also is data gathering. Whenever I ride my motorcycle, I always treat it as a behavior experiment, most especially for myself. Patience, understanding, but also I like to study the human psyche, especially the Filipino, in traffic, because people turn into monsters in traffic, but they also turn into really, really nice people. You see the very large gap. And when I ride a motorcycle, I realize two things very quickly. One, cars are so cumbersome. There's one person in a metal coffin designed for seven people, but it's only one person multiplied by 100,000 with one person inside designed for five. So I'm like, why was that even designed that way? And two, man, we could really use better public transport, you know? So there is no connection to AI except for the fact that I've been running an AI script for the past, I don't know, 16 days already, how to fix traffic for the next 10 years in Metro Manila. I'm going to print it out and I'm going to go to the government, to at least the people I know in the Senate. I will say, I have a plan. Maybe we can follow it. Of course, they're not going to follow it. As long as it doesn't make them money. So I love that you asked me about motorcycling, because I only drive my car now to bring my girlfriend home to her province, to Bulacan, and to put my mountain bikes on the back of my truck and go to the mountains. But when I ride my motorcycle, I love the word you used, man, analog. It's the most analog thing. Because I ride an old manual motorcycle. It's not even a semi-automatic. It's a manual motorcycle where it's old, man. And I love it because it's something that's not digital at all, but reacts to every input I put in. It reacts to every prompt I do to it. And I look really cool. I think the only connection I have to AI when I'm on my motorcycle is it's the most amount of time I'm disconnected from AI when I'm on my motorcycle, because I make sure my phone's nowhere near my hands. I just like the road. And you know how it is in Manila, man. You lose attention for 1 second. Ah, you're gone, dude.
I sometimes think of that experience on the road, and I'm in the car, not on the motorcycle. So I know exactly what you mean. And the cars suffer because they can't go very fast, whereas the motorcycles can zip along.
Yeah.
It seems like when I'm in that traffic driving and watching the motorcycles running side by side as I'm going down the streets, there's some kind of collective consciousness thing going on.
Yes, yes, I agree.
I don't know what it is, but you can feel the vibration. Now, yeah. A lot of people talk about their spiritual vibration of things, and that's certainly out there. But this is a grounded vibrational sensibility that I feel watching everybody move all at once. And I've wondered, we have the digital space, which is carried with our cell phone towers, all the connections that we have. Everybody on those motorcycles, they have their, especially the Grab drivers that bring the food to your house, they have their cell phones. They're connected digitally. And they're also connected to that collective consciousness, this analog. And I, maybe call me naive, Carlos, but I think there's got to be some sort of overlap with all of that. AI is in the mix, because if I'm using digital space to direct me, then I am connected to AI. So yeah. I somehow see an intense overlap in all of that congestion, terrible traffic, and yet there's a beauty there.
There were studies on that, actually, like why people don't hit each other when it's so close, you know, and traffic seems to flow. It's so tight, but still there's a flow to it. And there were studies on that. There's like a lot of theories on it, like how does Waze know how many cars are there? Of course, it's the GPS stuff and all those things. But what is that river that everyone's on? I agree with you. It could be cell phone signal. It could be human energy. It could be man and machine sort of thing. Because I've never really considered to answer that question, but I feel it's... Some things, James, I leave to magic, man. Like music. Like music. Like why do people smile when I sing a certain chord or I play a certain song? You know, it's music. It's magic. It's just, yeah, I like that. I like that. I'm gonna AI that later. Like the traffic thing. I think it's just really part of us being. My friend from Hong Kong said it best. People who live in Manila and the Philippines are like playing a video game with the difficulty level set to hard because of how slow governance is here, how bad, you know, politics is, how poor we are in terms of being corrupt and being, but we're still smiling. So we're playing a video game and the difficulty level is set to high. And, you know, we're just playing, man. So those are those things that I feel are part of the game. You know, there's, you can call it a science. I call it a river. You know, there's probably something. I don't think you're naive. There's probably something there that's overlapping with the 5G signals, with the GPS map systems. Because when you look at a map, it's all lines. It's all rivers. The digital maps, like Google Maps or Waze. And I'm like, what does that really represent? What does, you know, when you're going somewhere, there's a line, right? And I'm like, what is that gated on? What is that fenced? What is it fencing in, you know? Like, it's kind of cool. It's kind of cool to think of. And I think that's one of the biggest things that AI excites me about, is because I can ask it questions that no one would really care to answer. Like that. AI would answer me no matter what, you know? And again, it goes back to the whole looking for warmth as a little boy kind of thing, because it'll always be there, you know?
And on that note, we've arrived at the end of our time together, which is a great place to close, back to the little boy. So, Carlos, thank you for taking the time to...
I appreciate you, James. What a wonderful time spent with you.
Yeah. So, more to come.
I'll see you soon, man.
So, there you go, my friends. Thus concludes my conversation with Carlos Castaño. I'm very excited about connecting more and more with Carlos, because he's helping me understand how to use AI creatively. He has a deep knowledge, as you can tell, and it's going to be a very interesting interaction with him over the next 6 or 7 months, because AI is moving really fast and I have a hard time keeping up with it. And yet, as you could tell in the conversation, I am curious about it and really quite enjoy it. So now I would like to shift gears just a little bit. We have some time left, and I'd like to offer you something that I experienced last week. I had an opportunity to give a talk, and the talk was titled Dying on Stage. And there were 100 people in the room. There were 12 speakers. I was the last one. So not only did I have my talk about working as an orderly in a nursing home with older men, this was in 1972, Much time has passed since then. I also realized, because I was the last one to come up to speak, I had to do a bit of a conclusion as well, just to wrap up the whole show. So I had enough presence of mind to record it. So what I'd like to do now is to offer you what I recorded last Saturday when I spoke as the last speaker. And the title of the show was Dying on Stage, and it was all about how we relabel the way we look at things that are difficult. Dying is certainly one of those things that we tend to shy away from. There are other things we tend to shy away from as well, like how do you deal with war? How do you deal with poverty? How do you label and unlabel things so that it makes it easier to talk about? So that was the goal of the afternoon. So here's what I had to say to close out the show. It's 1972. I'm working as an orderly at Wesley Nursing Center in Charlotte, North Carolina, on Shamrock Drive. I'm there because I'm a conscientious objector, and I'm serving 2 years alternate service in lieu of going to the American War in Vietnam. I'm 22 years old. I was fit. And the reason I was fit, because I lived on 8th Street. And 8th Street was about 5 miles away from Wesley Nursing Center. And every morning I would get on my touring bike and I would ride through the early morning hours of Charlotte to Wesley Nursing Center. And I would arrive there at 6:30, change out of my riding gear, put on my very nice white uniform, and I would report to the second floor for the staff meeting. Mrs. Jones, the head nurse, would assign us patients. My job as the orderly was to take care of these old men on the west wing of the fifth floor. I cleaned their bedpans. I served them food. I would shave them, give them baths, and take care of them. These men were in their late 70s, in their 80s. They were at the end of their life. I was 22. I was at the beginning of my life. So I would get my little list of 4 or 5 men I needed to take care of, and I would go down the west wing and go to Mr. Ridenour's room. And Mr. Ridenour was a jolly fellow with no legs because he had lost his legs to diabetes. But he always loved to see me come round because he liked for me to give him a little bath, and he liked for me to shave him. And the next door was Mr. Wilson. Mr. Wilson was 47, maybe. He had MS, and his wife would come every day and take care of him. And I always felt so sorry for Mr. Wilson because I could tell he wanted something that he didn't have anymore. And his wife wanted that too. Then there was Reverend Gibbs. I'm walking into Reverend Gibbs' room every morning, 22 years old, and there he sits. And Reverend Gibbs had a bathrobe on, scruffy pajamas. He was a Methodist minister. He looked like a Harvard professor, right? He loved to smoke these little cigars. Now, in 1972, you could smoke cigars in your room, and he wanted me to light the cigars. And he light my cigar. And he was very jolly. He was happy. He liked to see me. He liked to have conversations. So after lunch, what he liked most especially to do, being the well-educated Methodist minister that he was, he wanted me to sit with him and watch the soap operas. So we would watch Guiding Light, All My Children, General Hospital. And we loved it. I loved the soaps too. My grandmother watched the soaps. She taught me how to appreciate the soaps. So we were watching the soaps. But he had a little sad tinge in his eye. And I never knew really why. So as I'm working there with him, cleaning him up or doing whatever I needed to do, he would tug my arm. He'd say, I need to tell you something. I need to tell you something. I said, well, what is it? What I need to tell you something. And it was a slight desperation, right? And he said, you're so young, and I'm not anymore. And you're such good shape, and you ride your bicycle to work every day. And he said, go out and live. Don't, you just go do things. I don't care what you do, just go do things. The subtext was, don't do like I did. I think I conformed a little bit more than I would like to, and I'd much rather have been the Harvard professor in the Bohemian somewhere in the Northeast. Tug, 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 tug. And as he was tugging my arm, this timeline emerged And I realized I'm on this end of the timeline and Reverend Gibbs is on that end of the timeline. And so is Mr. Ridenour. And so are all these other men that I'm taking care of. But I'm here and it's going to move very slowly. And I've got plenty of time. So September 1972, I departed. Off I went. And I lived. I didn't do everything exactly the way I was supposed to. And yet I did it. And it was good and it was bad and it was up and it was down. And I kept thinking, I've got plenty of time. And the phones ring. You see, that's beautiful. Thank you very much for leaving that. I love cell phones. I'm totally digitalized. And I moved down that timeline and I'm 45 years old. And I'm thinking, you know, it's picking up. I'm no longer 22. And then 62 comes along and I get prostate cancer. I'm getting a little closer to Reverend Gibbs. And I got through the prostate cancer. Everything came out okay, and I kept moving. I'm now 76, and I am probably 2 years shy of Reverend Gibbs right now. That time ran really, really fast. I think about how important it is to do what Reverend Gibbs was trying to tell me to do, and here's the message that he was giving me. Somewhere along that line, I realized he was tugging my wrist and saying, please label yourself alive. Label yourself alive and let the label of alive tell you what to do. You don't need to tell it what to do. Let the label of alive tell you what to do. And now we are here right now in this room, all of us together. We're the poets. They're right here, right now. And we're in a time that is very powerful. There's war going on, if you haven't noticed it. You all are aware of that. There was an American war in Vietnam. There's an American war elsewhere right now. This is our time as poets, as writers, as creatives, as people who have taken the time to come into this room. You all are here. This is our time to do something. The most important person in the world is the one right in front of you. And when you show up and engage with that person, you're doing the work that you were asked to do when you first entered this world. And it's all about beauty, and it's all about joy, and it's all about showing up. And in the end, when that final moment comes, when you die, it could be the most pleasurable thing you've ever experienced. We don't know. But what we do know is it will come. And when it does, you can, I label myself alive. And as far as beauty goes, I'll close with this. The poet Charles Wright says, all beauty begins with disappearance. The bitten edges of things. The gradual sliding away into tissue and memory. The uncertainty and dazzling impermanence of days we beg our meanings from and their frayed loveliness. The uncertainty and dazzling impermanence of days we beg our meanings from and their frayed loveliness. Thank you. And so there you go. That's what I had to say last Saturday afternoon. I did use AI to help me with this. When I first started out, I wasn't quite sure how to tell the story. So I recorded this story, moth style, off the top of my head. And then I dropped that transcript into AI and asked for an evaluation. What works? What doesn't work? How can I organize it? Do I have everything in the right place? AI gave me all of that information back. I used that information to reformat the story and take another run at it. So I went through many revisions, all speaking from the moth storytelling point of view, not from the AI point of view. So AI supported the work. In the end, I had to step up there and present what you just heard off the top of my head, which is really not off the top of my head, all the prep followed what was coming out as I spoke to the group. And when you put those two together, as Carlos pointed out in our conversation, you can have a good result. If you rely heavily on AI and you don't call on your imagination to participate, you might bump into some cliches. If you let your imagination lead the dance, you will have AI as a support without having to worry about it overwhelming you, because your imagination is a very powerful proposition. And I'm grateful for that. I'm grateful for mine, and I'm grateful for your imagination. And I'm also most especially grateful for you tuning into this show, Twice 5 Miles Radio, fertile ground for conversations worth listening to and remembering. I'm your host, James Nave. Thank you, Walter Parks, for our theme song, walterparks.com, for more on Walter's music. Davine Dial, thank you for managing WPVM-FM in Asheville. And Robin Collier and Mike Tilley, thank you for running and managing KCEI-FM, Cultural Energy Radio, in Taos. If you would ever like to reach me, I would love to hear from you. My email, nave@jamesnave.com. Nave is spelled N-A-V-E. And if you happen to be free on any Saturday between 12 and 1 p.m. Eastern Time, my creative collaborator Allegra Houston and I host a free writing circle on Zoom. We gather with writers from all over the place, and we just work for an hour, and we only spend 10 minutes generating a piece of writing, and then we read it aloud. It's great fun. You can come. You don't ever have to write. You can just be part of the participation as an audience, if you know what I mean. You can find the link to that gathering at jamesnave.com. Nave spelled N-A-V-E. So on that note, once again, thank you ever so much for tuning in to Twice 5 Miles Radio. I do appreciate your time with us, and I hope you come back soon. And until then, I'll catch you on that turnaround somewhere down the line.
The radio is an art form, you know. We don't want it to die, and I'm afraid that the people that buy all the radio stations might forget that this is not just a tool to make money. It's part of our society. It colors the way we act, the way we treat each other. You know, it's much bigger than a tool to make money. It's an art form. So, but what's great, what's ultimately the best about it, is it's fun and it's entertaining. And that's all we want to do is raise that question of, hey, how come we're not having as much fun as we did?
Can't live without.
Thank you for tuning in to WPVMLP, Asheville, North Carolina, 103.7, streaming online, WPVMFM.org, the voice of Asheville, heard all over the world.
From Feature Story News in Brussels, I'm William Denslow. Israel's hit Tehran with new airstrikes, although says it will now hold off further attacks on gas fields. Qatar's energy minister